Welcome to the MS Dev Show, episode number 156. This week, we talk with Matt Heidinger and Thomas Fennell about adaptive cards, Amazon giveth and Amazon taketh away, redesigning the volume slider, announcements from WWDC, and we look forward to the Xbox One X.
This episode of the MS Dev Show is brought to you by Espose, the market leader of .NET and Java APIs for file business formats. Natively work with DocX, XSLX, PPT, PDF, MSG, MPP, image formats, and many more.
This week we have Matt Heidinger and Thomas Fennell, program managers on the Windows Developer Platform team. How's it going, guys?
Good. Good. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah. Yep. Carl, what do we have for the comment of the week?
The comment of the week we got off of iTunes. It's Team Rogue. He gave us 5 stars and said, "This show is good because Jason and Carl make it all about the guests and get into the work. Keep up the good work, guys." And then he goes on about the keyboard shortcut episode that we had a while back, and Jason being able to correct himself right in the middle of the show.
Yes, I'm so amazing. No, actually, what was useful about this is he pointed out, because I was mentioning that, like, calculators, and I was trying to figure out, there's 2 different number pad variations and they're backwards from each other. And he mentioned that he thinks it's the phone dialer as opposed to the 10 digit keypad. Are backwards. So thank you for that clarification, because I was trying to figure out which one was backwards. So thank you for that.
Yep. So Team Rogue, send us your email address and you will get the espose.total for .NET, which includes all of the espose.NET products in one package. You wanted to say something, Thomas?
No, it's fine. I was just going to say that everybody knows that the numpad layout is superior to the phone dialer layout. You grew up with a big keyboard. Like, I mean, that's not going to be controversial, is it?
Hang on. Tabs or spaces is coming next.
No, it's tabs. But let's move on to that. Are we all in agreement? Because then we don't even have to discuss it.
Tabs.
Uh-oh, Thomas is like, he's quiet.
I was like, did Skype freeze or did he?
His face is getting red. I use spaces, just to be clear, though. So hopefully Thomas is okay with that. I use spaces.
Ah, that's better. That's better. You know what's right. You just are programmed the wrong way. It's
fine. Okay, anyway, let's jump into the news here. So the first one, Amazon drops unlimited cloud storage for individuals. Yeah, this sucks.
Yeah, because I know, what was it, 2 years ago, everybody kind of had unlimited storage, and then they all dropped it. And then, like, right at that time, Amazon was like, "Hey, everybody, unlimited storage."
Yeah, and those jerks over there, sorry, they were, well, I'm super bitter because, you know, they offered, like, they had a Black Friday deal as well for $5 for a year for unlimited storage. And this is, like, everybody else dropped unlimited storage, and then they started unlimited storage. So, like, that was their chance to not screw this up. So I was like, okay, they must got this. You know, this is a loss leader. They're trying to push something else. You know, I have a fiber connection, so I just push everything in there. You know, so I guess I'm one of the people that probably ruined
it for everybody. So you ruined it for us.
Yeah, I didn't have that much. I was actually, I just hit a terabyte, which I don't think is that unreasonable. So they just switched their plan now. So for the same price, which is their normal price is $60 a year, you only get 1 terabyte. Well, I'm at the limit, and if it's only 1 terabyte, well, then I'm going to use OneDrive, right? Or Dropbox. I mean, they're all limited to 1 terabyte. And I'm already paying for Dropbox, and I'm paying for OneDrive through Office 365. So, like, their interface and everything was just terrible to use. So, like, the only thing they had going for them was unlimited storage, and now there's this mass exodus from there. I don't know. I kind of wish they had grandfathered people in a little bit better. It's whenever your plan renews. So, like, if your plan renews today, like, you're done. They just start deleting stuff. I just wish they had a better plan. Even if it was like 10, you know, let's say $10 a terabyte or something that you went over. I don't know, some kind of plan for people to slowly migrate off. So now I'm just moving just massive files over. Dropbox, they still offer unlimited in their business version, but there's some ambiguity about what unlimited actually means. I contacted sales because it, like, popped up, you know, with that little chat thing whenever I was on their website, I said, is there something I can help you with? I said, yes, actually. I said, what does unlimited mean? And they're like, oh, we don't have unlimited. I'm sorry. And I'm like, I'm sorry. It says, as much space as you need is what they say. They don't say unlimited, as much space as you need. And I said, okay, well, what does that mean? And they're like, well, you get a terabyte, and if you need more, we bump it up. And I was like, yeah, I get it. Like, how much can I actually get? And they said, sorry, this isn't support. So I reached out to support, and they said, well, it's unlimited. Like, we'll just keep bumping it up for you. And I was like, oh, so like 5 or 10 terabytes, like, that's fine. And they said, absolutely. Well, there's this Reddit thread that has people in there, like, sharing their experiences. Half the people say, I got to 2 terabytes. Like, one person said, I got to 2 terabytes. They will not raise it for me anymore. Another person said, hey, I'm up to 25 terabytes. And, like, they're still happy with it. And I'm like, okay, so I don't know. So it's a big mystery. I don't know who offers unlimited storage. I think OneDrive, the business version, still offers unlimited. But again, like, I haven't done any research to see if that actually means unlimited either. I kind of get it because, you know, you could have a petabyte, you know, obviously is going to be like a huge loss if somebody were to use it in that capacity. So I just wish there was a little bit more definition around these, like, you know, saying, hey, you know, around 20-ish terabytes, like, then you're starting to get into this kind of gray area. Like, even like a statement like that would be really useful, because the issue that I have with 1 terabyte is not even that I necessarily have like that much, although I actually do have that much now, but like, there's a wall there. Like, once you hit a terabyte, then you're just done. Like, Dropbox on their personal plans, there's no option. Like, they will not take your money past that point. So it's like, I just want some options past that.
You know, the thing is, you're eventually going to have to be able to shuttle this stuff around too. Like, at some point, aren't you going to be like, well, okay, I can't be here anymore. I'm going to have to move it over there. I mean, there's a business opportunity here. Maybe, like, you need to come up with a business that lets people move stuff from the people who can't make up their minds about how much storage you get.
Yeah.
Like, just shuttle it around. You know what? Like, you know how people put a bunch of debt on a credit card and then they end up moving all the debt to a different
card? Right.
That one has 0% interest. Like, you're going to have to do that with storage at some point.
I think there are some services that do it. They tend to be expensive, because I thought about just running some of the clients like in an Azure instance. But the issue is you get hit with like outbound data transfer rates or data transfer costs. I guess that's the big thing. So if you were to operate a service like that at scale, like, you have to charge a decent amount for it to be moving around terabytes worth of data. But I think those services exist. I've searched for them before, and I'm pretty sure they popped up. But they're a little scary too. Giving them access to the data and then having them like move it without issue. It's just, it's a little scary.
People you really got to watch out for are the ones that offer to do it for free.
Yeah. Yeah.
they're getting something out of moving that data. Like, that's.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Okay. So I think we can move on from that one. Resume anti-pattern. So this came up recently. I've seen a lot of resumes. I've actually in the past have helped people with their resume improve them. And so I just searched for resume anti-patterns, because I saw a resume recently that I'm pretty sure like hit on like every anti-pattern. So I did find an article on this. And so I'll just kind of read. There was only 4 points that they made, but the keyword encyclopedia, red fuzzy underline, so basically grammar and spelling mistakes. Homer's Odyssey, so basically too long.
Part of that too is we still need to know about your experience in 1997 doing web forms with an access.
Yeah, I know.
Come on,
I know. I saw a resume with that recently. Yeah, just like just tons and tons of out of date information. So here, I'll give you the short version on how to have a good resume. Ultimately, what you want to do is you want to show impact. So like, here was the result of whatever, and here was my role in it. And if you can just make some statements like that and then weave in the things that you know based on that, that's it. That's all that I ever look for. Other than like, you know, your name and maybe your like your phone number and or address, I don't think there's anything else that's really important beyond that. Obviously, if you're you know, just coming into this and you don't have the right you don't have a lot of experience, then you know, you're gonna put down education. But again, I want evidence that you know what you're talking about and can do things for in the position that you're being hired for.
So I think it's really you know, like great to aspire to something like that. But I know that there's a lot of places, especially if you're trying to look at some place that's like maybe local, mm-hmm. a lot of them, their HR departments optimize for these anti-patterns though. Like if you don't have those 32, you know, three letter acronym abbreviations on there, you're just not going to get to the top of the pile and you're not going to move on. So you almost need two, you know, that you hand in at the same time. You're like, grade this one for this way, grade that one for that way.
Yeah, run this one through your this is for the HR department and this is for the hiring manager.
you do raise an interesting point though, because you know, it's certainly not really likely that I could do that. But if you are applying for a job where you know you can get directly to someone that, you know, you'll skip that first step, mm-hmm. you almost would want one that's more not gonna be buzzword compliant if it's going just to, you know, straight up to a HR department.
Yeah. And again, if you have to, like, weave in those buzzwords, I guess is my point. Mm-hmm. You say, hey, I saved the company, you know, or I, you know, was able to, you know, increase profits of this product by $3 million by doing X, Y, and Z. And I used, you know, .NET and C# and SQL Server and, you know, kind of explain that. I think if you had, you know, five of those statements on your resume, and that was like the big part of your resume, personally, that's like ideally what I would like to see. And then what you could do is you could bold the technology one so that HR, when they do their check, they're like, yep, I see the buzzwords. this is what I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I mean, every situation is different, obviously, but I don't know this list of like, I know, and you list like every technology that you ever even heard of. I don't know. It's good for HR. It's good for nobody else.
You guys don't care about my COBOL experience? Like, is that what I'm hearing? Like, nobody.
Well, maybe, maybe. I don't know. Like, it's still being used, right?
True. Hey,
so if you, seriously, like if you, you know, I don't know, did something amazing and, you know, you were using COBOL, like go ahead and call it out if you think it's at all relevant. There's a time and a place for everything. Move on. Redditors design worst volume sliders possible. I hope you get. Do you guys have a link to this one? This one.
Oh, I clicked on it on my bus ride into work this morning. I mean, the creativity is through the roof.
Yeah. So you have to. Everybody will have to go to our show notes to look at these. But you know, I can kind of explain. Like the first one is it's like the traditional volume slider that pops up, except that you have to slide it horizontally within like, you know, a 10 pixel range. That one's pretty good, and they just keep getting better from there. The next one is what was that game? What is the game? There's what was it? Monkeys or bananas or gorillas in Basic, where you'd like set your trajectory and like the angle. that's like the next one.
It was like that cannon game that we used to play.
Yeah, I was gonna say you probably have like a newer example.
Yeah.
But basically you hold on the volume thing and it like builds up and then it shoots the volume onto the slider. and then they just keep getting better though. I love this one. Please, it's a picture of a microphone that says, please make a noise as loud as you want the volume to be. This is now listening. Oh man, that's where I started to lose it. And then the next one is a screen full of dots randomly placed around, and you have to move them into the shape of the number of the volume percentage, and then it uses machine learning to detect what number you drew using those random dots. Oh, and then the next one is pretty funny. It's a volume slider, but you tip it back and forth to get the slider to move.
Mm-hmm.
What is the next one here?
It's based upon your geography, where your latitude is. Latitude.
Please simply move your device to a new location with the latitude as your desired volume. The next one is like a whole bunch of dice and you have to keep rolling them. It's like Yahtzee, where you hold on to certain dice to pick your volume. What's the next one here? Oh, it's the slide. This is like, you ever play a golf game where you have to like push the button at like just the right time? That's basically the volume slider there. The next one is like really hard to understand because it's
like those games where you gotta like just tap the dots at the right time.
Where you gotta
time.
Tap all the dots at the right time, but it's like minus, plus, X.
And one that'll reset it.
Yeah, one that'll reset it. There's like mines. And you have to hit the arrow just the right time to like pick the right option. And then this next one is one of the best ones too. What is this game called? I'm blanking on it. Where you push the puck and then there's the people with the sweepers there, the brooms.
Oh my God!
We're so close to Canada.
All the Canadians are going, "Oh my God!
This is horrible." Curling.
That's curling. It.
Yeah, yeah. So it's basically curling, and you'd use the little broom to pick where to help pick how far the volume slider goes. Oh, and then this is crazy. I'm describing these. I apologize because hopefully you can go watch these. But the next one is, it works on a Mac, and it goes. I didn't even know. Is that based on the? I don't know. How do they know
the light?
Oh, it's based intensity. On the ambient sensor. Okay, so you use the ambient sensor to adjust the volume. And then the next one is radio buttons with every value between 1 and 100. And then there's a checkbox that's mute.
Saw in the comments at the end of those that someone actually took the initiative to start implementing some of them. So you can actually install these and use them as your real.
Yeah, they're out on they're out on JS Fiddle. Which one?
So I've seen another person made you type the digits of pi. And if you made a mistake, then it reset immediately.
Oh, nice. Oh, I like, yeah, so they got a link.
That's better than maximum volume.
Yeah, they got a JS Fiddle to the one where you shoot the little cannon, the volume cannon. That's actually pretty cool. Okay, so max volume's easy to get to because you just hold it down and then let go. But anyway,
how often do you want max volume though?
It's actually kind of fun. I don't know. I'm very extreme, like max volume all the time. Whenever I get done with a podcast too, like everybody in the office around me, they're like, "You're loud." Sorry.
I'm not loud. I'm just extreme.
Yeah. Yeah. Extreme podcasting.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. What do we got next here? Oh, WWDC. And I was basically asked, do you guys want this with extreme snark?
Always.
Okay. So I got lots of snark. So I apologize in advance because I'm going to be really snarky here. I'm going to go through the announcements very quickly here, and then we can kind of come back and talk about them. So here's what you missed from WWDC. Apple announced a speaker that's just like the one that we announced, the Harman Kardon device. So basically building a intelligent speaker with good sound. They're making the iPad more Windows-like. The iPhone is getting a Do Not Disturb feature from the Windows phone. They are coming out with a toolkit called ARKit to compete with HoloLens. The MacBook Pro is dropping in price, and they're updating their chips so that they can compete with the Surface. The iMac, they come out with a new iMac Pro to compete with Windows hardware. And again, I intentionally threw a whole bunch of snark in there. So all the things they're copying. And then other kind of honorable mentions, they announced WatchOS 4. They really only showed like two features, which was just more screens. So one is a Siri screen that's kind of interesting. Sierra got high. Now they have High Sierra, which has very few things that they showed off there. Apple person-to-person payments, which I actually think is pretty cool. The question is, like, how do you set that up with your bank, though? But I'm all for, like, making person-to-person payments easier. And then one that I think is kind of big, Amazon Video is coming to Apple TV. That was, like, the app that they were missing there. So snark aside, like, you know, they had a smorgasbord of actually, you know, pretty good improvements. There was nothing like that got me particularly excited. I know Carl, you were you thought ARKit was kind of significant.
Yeah, I think that with all of the devices that they have and how well they've made this at least look like it works, I think that they have a serious inroads just getting this to that many devices immediately, even though it's not up to the full HoloLens like experience.
Yeah,
I think that when they actually do come up with something that does compete with the HoloLens, having, you know, this work for so many other devices will really give them a heads up.
Yeah. I think this is super exciting because it's kind of like, you know, Pokemon, like they did their own thing, but now app developers don't have to like reinvent AR. They can just build on top of this. I think that that's actually super significant. I think it's going to be interesting to see where people push it. I think this will be one of the big things that pushes AR forward. And then, that's just going to help out the HoloLens because, you know, it's going to open up a lot of those different scenarios. And a lot of the scenarios we talked about with HoloLens, like decorating your house or things like that, like those will be accessible, right? Because I'm guessing a year from now, what you'll be able to do is go to Amazon and say, hey, I like this. Well, maybe they're a bad example because I don't know how good they are with like buying furniture, but whatever. You go to your furniture app of choice, right? And it'll be like, oh, place this in my home. And you'll be able to do that right from your phone and see what that looks like.
Yeah, a lot of those, I may be overgeneralizing, but some of these trends were a lot in just convergence of these experiences. I mean, a lot of it was just being, to me, you mentioned the payment one, which I think is interesting, the whole person-to-person payment. I mean, I have been using Venmo and Square Cash for a long time. And the way they work, you just take a picture of your debit card and they work through that. So it's incredibly simple and you just pay through people. And Venmo is an interesting one because they brought social to it. And I fire up my Venmo app and it shows, I mean, from even old high school friends, because it's linked to your Facebook from back in Michigan that I haven't seen in 20 years, but I can still pay see that they're paying someone $40 for pizza. And it literally is this stream of people exchanging money. And I turned mine immediately to private. And I'm a relatively open about social media. And I was like, but I don't want people to know what I'm paying for. So
that could get interesting.
I think it's an interesting one that I think Venmo and Square Cash, and Square Cash is just Square, and they have a fork of it that just does person to person, and they don't take any cut. You do have a set, they keep the money in there, so you have to manually transfer it, similar to PayPal, to your bank account, and it takes about 4 days. But what's interesting is, I will show, as someone who's recently been in the dating world, there's something interesting about me. I had a Windows phone forever, obviously. Now I'm using the S8 Plus, but it's really weird to be, described and interpreted as one of the green bubbles to iPhone people. Because when you're talking to their iMessage people, they're blue bubbles. When you SMS with someone, I just the green bubble. And it's this weird thing about just being different. As technology gets more and more social and about a status type thing. So I really think this payment stuff is going to be interesting as more iPhone users start to just pay each other with this. Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, oh, can you Venmo me that? And I wonder if Venmo is the status quo. Everyone uses Venmo every day, as long as according to my social feed. And it'll be interesting to see if that's still the case in a couple years, or if I'm just the weirdo who just can't accept iMessage payments.
Well, you're the weirdo, and I think that anytime Apple does something natively like this, I mean, it just kills like most of the competition. I guess the counterexample to that would be like Spotify and Apple Music. I mean, Spotify is like so much better that people are like, no, I'm not using Apple Music, even though it has kind of native integration and things like that. So,
well, I think part of it too with the like when you bring up that iMessage bubble thing is Apple has this really, I think, good, I'm going to say good as in it's effective. They have an effective way of doing it through design, whereas that blue is just really pleasing. It looks good, whereas that green is actually kind of garish and hard to read. So, it kind of reinforces what they want you to do. And that's where I have a problem. Like when we go to like the speaker, I know that their music app is going to work really great with that, but I don't like their music app. I use third party apps. Mm-hmm. So how well is that going to work with a speaker? Probably not that great. So, there is a kind of a self-selecting, when you're in those ecosystems, they try to design you to stay within that.
Yeah, they should use like Comic Sans and like the green bubbles. I never even thought of that though.
Really make us feel shame.
Yeah.
It's so funny though. Like it comes up on first dates. People are like, so aren't you a blue bubble? And I'm like the only one. So they're like, they don't even get it.
You're a green bubbler.
I'm showing you someone, why are you in a different color? And I'm like, oh, it's because we're using an old service called SMS.
It is funny though that like people don't understand that either. Though the blue bubbles are really nice though, because like when I'm texting somebody and I'm not like sure that it's their number or whatever, you type it in and like immediately it goes bloop, it flips to iMessage. And I'm like, okay, I got the right thing. And so I actually it's so sticky, like they're
And that's why I think payments is going to be a special one, not quite just like the speaker or anything. I mean, those you have to buy. Like this, the sending payments to someone is going to be so automatic that you won't even think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, they will for you.
Yeah, they'll be like, why can't I send you money? I guess you don't get money.
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
No, you want me to install an app? No. And put in my debit card? No.
Yeah. Anything else we want to talk about here? I mean, I was snarky about it, but like I said, I mean, I think their speaker's interesting because it'll, it's more of a Sonos compete. Everybody's comparing it to like the Echo or the Google Home, but you know, it's actually a good sounding speaker. I think that's a sound strategy because ultimately, as long as it has the microphones in it and those work well, like you can fix everything else with software. So if you get the first round of people buying it for the sound quality, and then you get the second round of people buying it for the sound quality plus, you know, Siri being awesome, I think that's a pretty sound strategy. The iPad is still not appealing at all to me personally, but you know, I think they're doing some of the right things there. I think that's about it. Okay, and then last news story, which I am excited about, but you know, it's kind of won't necessarily come through, which is the Xbox One X, which we've described before. I mean, it's just a super high-end true 4K gaming machine, and they went all out on this thing. It's like 12 gigs of memory and super high-end CPU, and it's smaller than the S even, but really nice hardware. Looking forward to it. Comes out in November for $499, which I actually think is a reasonable price. It costs more than the PS4 Pro, but it's more, you know, it is more powerful. And then prices, you know how they are, they always drop down pretty quickly anyway.
Yeah, the price thing seemed to get a lot of people. It was totally like divided down the middle. Like $499 is way too much. And then the going back to the Apple speaker, like isn't that thing $349?
Yeah, yeah, that's so, a good point.
Like, $349. Like I saw that on Twitter. Somebody,
well,
like,
everybody. Yeah, but everybody's whining about that price too. So.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
But then I saw somebody else say, "Hey, you know, like my massive graphics card costs $900. Like,
yeah.
To get a whole system for $500 feels all right." Like,
yeah, I gotta think that there's I don't know anything about that division, but I gotta think that there's not much margin on that. Yeah. You know, after a few months of production, I'm guessing they can squeeze, you know, some margin out of it, and then you can drop the price. But I guess we'll wait and see. So that's super exciting. And then I guess the other effect of that was that at least temporarily, I'm hoping it's permanent, but the Xbox One S, which does, you know, 4K streaming. It's actually a really nice 4K streaming machine. Plus, you know, a good Xbox overall, dropped down $200. I mean, that's, whoa. I mean, I paid $130 for my Roku 4, you know, the high end Roku. Like we're getting into that territory. I mean, that's crazy. I mean, it seems like those things should really be moving now.
Mm-hmm. You guys saw I think I read this right. I'm still can't believe it's true. Xbox games, original Xbox games.
Backwards compatibility.
Some of them. Yeah, they're bringing out like, yeah.
Still, like, oh. I mean, I until very recently actually had some of those discs lying around. I don't now. I had
Well, that's why they added it.
They're like, we're waiting for Thomas to sell all these games.
Yeah, sell.
Oh, man. That's awesome. There's a few at least.
I don't know if they hold up though. I recently I hooked up my original Nintendo for my kids just like a couple weeks ago, and they actually say that that's their favorite system, which is pretty funny. But I actually hooked up my original PlayStation 1. I hooked that up like 2 years ago, and I was thinking like, yeah, Crash Bandicoot and like some of the racing games and stuff. I'm like, those things were like, they were like flawless. I hooked it up. I'm like, oh my god,
like, yeah,
you know, they don't hold up well on a 70-inch TV, I can tell you.
For
that
me, the ones I'll never play again are my Nintendo 64, because it's got such fond memories, but then you play them and they're really bad.
Yeah you either gonna
there's no sense ruining those memories, just keep them as really positive
I
memories.
Think if you go super,
Ocarina of Time was perfect.
Yeah, if you go like super retro though, I think it gets interesting again, like Nintendo and
Atari,
things like that.
Yeah, I mean, we're even seeing a lot of mobile games coming out or taking on that old style, and they're making them really compelling. So, yeah, I think it was that middle area that people are like, yeah.
Yep. Okay, well, we're out of time, so that was it for questions. Sorry, that was a long news segment, but there is some good stuff in there. So yeah, we wanted to jump in and talk about adaptive cards, because there was a lot of excitement at Build around this, and we wanted to hear from the experts. So I guess we should start with helping out our audience that hasn't heard of these. You know, like, what are adaptive cards?
Yeah. So. Yeah, and probably many of you haven't heard of them yet because we're just starting to kind of spread them around. But effectively, you know, since a handful of your audience is going to be window developers, they'll remember what we were trying to do with live tiles and notifications. And no doubt a number of them have met me over the years and told me, just let me put XAML on my live tile, let me draw whatever I want. Mm-hmm. And while we try to enable that, and we've tried to, there's always these kind of competing interests in that ultimately your content is being hosted and served up in this other experience. It's being hosted in Start, or it's being hosted in Action Center. And we started to see the same thing happen with bots. You'd talk to a bot through Skype or through even Microsoft Teams. You can talk to bots. Cortana surfaces up content. So you've got these people who want to get their content into these apps. And really opening up something like freeform UI, like just here's a chat bubble in Skype, and you know, you're the Foursquare bot or the Yelp bot. We can't just really give you just draw whatever you want. The user would lose all the cognitive load, especially when you're scrolling through a chat thread, if everyone chooses their own font weights or their own type ramps and their own margins and things. So what Adaptive Cards tries to do is bridge that middle ground between, okay, you're an app, you're like Skype or you're Microsoft Teams, you clearly have a strong brand like any, you know, well-known app is, and we want to let you open up to a third-party ecosystem, open up to the breadth of developers in a controlled way. And that's really what Adaptive Cards let you do. It's this JSON payload that says, okay, you're a bot developer, you know, text is great, but obviously sometimes, you know, let's say I'm ordering something through a bot and it wants to send me a receipt. Well, you know, sending a text-based receipt would be a little kind of, It certainly isn't the user experience you're looking for. And then custom drawing an HTML one would also be a little weird, especially as, you know, I think the value prop of bots is that, unlike apps, they're all about breadth for free. You want it, they're chat-based. If you want to write a bot once, and that's the big thing about the bot framework that we've been working on, is that you write your bot once and now any user can be on Facebook Messenger, they can be on Slack, they can be on Skype, they can be on Microsoft Teams, and they can talk to your same bot. So they abstract away that transport mechanism. And that's what bots are. They're about that reach. Mm-hmm. And adaptive cards are trying to make the visual part of that consistent and across reach. So tangibly, what that really means is that you describe an adaptive card in this JSON payload. And when it gets sent to Skype, it looks and feels like Skype. When you send it to Teams, it looks and feels like Microsoft Teams. So the content adapts to the host that it's in, and you as the developer don't have to think about that.
Yeah, this really reminds me. Sorry, Carl. This really reminds me of the web, right? Because on the on the web, like, you can do anything you want, but then it's a huge pain because you have to test against every size, form factor, every different browser, different rendering engines, blah, blah, blah. And in many cases, it's like, I don't want to focus on those things. There's certain content I want to get to the person, and I do want it to look a certain way. And that's why I gravitate towards something like Markdown. So it seems like kind of a similar thing, like a happy middle ground.
It took us a while to really articulate it. Once we were kind of building this thing, Thomas and I, you know, we've been, you know, whiteboarding around. In fact, he was like, you probably have to erase some stuff back there. I was like, no, I think
it's a little blurry.
But yeah, we've ultimately realized we're just the Markdown for cards. It's the same thing. Whereas, you know, you write your Markdown is for documents, right? You author it in a specific, a finite window of things. And then they guarantee that all documents look the same. And we're doing the same thing, but more than just text, where you can have columns and you can have a little more flexibility, but it's very similar in the idea.
Espose offers a powerful set of file management APIs with which developers can create applications, which can create, open, edit, and save the majority of popular business file formats. Their product range supports a multitude of file formats, including Word documents, Excel spreadsheets, PowerPoint presentations, PDF documents, OneNote, Outlook, Project, Visio files, popular image formats, and many others. Espose produces APIs for .NET, Java, and the cloud, which can be utilized in almost any modern language available today. Visit www.espose.com for a free 30-day no-limitations trial. And if you get stuck, message the friendly support team for help. All technical support is offered free of charge. Remember, if you're a lucky winner, you will receive a free developer small business license for espose.words for .NET, a powerful toolkit to work with Word documents in your applications.
All right, so first of all, I heard you say JSON, so I'd just like to say thank you.
Yeah, sure.
I don't know. You can thank us, but I feel like we're just, you know, you should be saying about time you did your job. Like, that's kind of the...
maybe there was a little bit of that tone that I was trying to get in there. A little bit failed a little bit. So, you know, I'm going to play the devil's advocate here. I mean, you brought up the concept of, like, you know, you want to display a receipt across these different things, but you said you also want them to look the same on Skype and, you know, all the native places, you know, look like iOS on iOS and look like Android on Android. But what if I'm like a kitschy little, you know, a hipster joint and I want it to look like a handwritten receipt or something like that? You're saying that I have to give up control of that?
Well, so... with adaptive cards, I mean, so here's what people are doing today. So on Facebook Messenger, which is the dominant messaging platform, you know, outside of, say, China, you basically have a handful of templates to choose from. And it's really a handful. I think it's like 8. And there's an airline itinerary template, an airline flight update template. And the reason they're templates is because Facebook wants to make sure that all Facebook Messenger users get the same feel of content. But what they also have is an image template. And that's what a lot of these bots are doing. They're custom drawing an image on the server and then choosing that template. So they're effectively breaking out of the artificial box anyway, but in a kind of crappy way, because those images, they don't always look right. They're not going to be accessible on high contrast devices. And ultimately, there are a lot of data. They can look blurry as you change resolution. So an image is kind of like a hack that the industry is taking to break out of that box. So you could do that with your handwriting example. But what we're trying to do is make it so you don't have to do that. You know, ultimately, you're competing with two interests. You know, you're trying to get your users and you're going through a third party. You're in this hosted environment. You're talking to Facebook Messenger users. So you will ultimately play by someone else's rules by the simple fact that it's not your app. You're going through someone. But what we're trying to do with adaptive cards is make you have to break out of that box and drop to an image less and less. Like, you should be able to achieve certain things that you want. Now, custom handwriting, your example might be a little too far to the extreme, but you should be able to do more and more stuff. Just like Markdown, you know, eventually added tables and things like that. Like, you should be able to do things and express them without having to cheat and draw custom images. And that's what we're trying to do.
And there's a spectrum too, Carl. Like, you, your example, if it, let's just say it's at the far extreme of something you can't do with adaptive cards. It doesn't.
Which is why I chose that.
And it doesn't mean that we're not at all trying to say that then you should give up on that. Like, if there's another stack that will let you do that in that example, like, if you can go full HTML in the places that you need to be to achieve that goal, then you should absolutely do that. Like, there are better technologies for some things than others. And we can't expect that everything will just work through adaptive cards or through HTML. It's the same thing that Matt said about, you know, there's a set of scenarios that Markdown is really, really good at. But then if you need to do a full custom web page with a bunch of CSS, you're not going to choose Markdown.
In a lot of cases, you know, I've been authoring, Microsoft is moving tons of our documentation to Markdown. It's been really fun. Everything's on docs.microsoft.com. I'm currently moving all of our stuff that's currently, we have a site called adaptivecards.io. And I hand rolled a bunch of doc stuff because we had to get it done in time, but we're moving all that. And Markdown's great, but sometimes, you know, there's custom code snippets that you want a little more flexibility. Mm-hmm. So Markdown lets you escape and write a little chunk of HTML, like just a little bit of chunk. And when we kind of think we're walking that same line, where if you do just want most of your content to be described in adaptive cards, but sometimes you have this kind of custom thing, we want to enable that escape hatch as well.
Okay. So what does the JSON that we're writing kind of look like then? You know, what kind of properties are you giving us? You know, how do we go about this?
Yeah. So it's mainly a set of building blocks. So the thing we like to, so for anyone listening, if they're happen to be in front of a computer and want to at least jump in, you just head to adaptivecards.io and you can click on samples, and we have a whole bunch of sample payloads. But I want to stress, and as I'm currently working on the site to make this more obvious, these are not templates. We're not trying to be a template language at all. We're trying to offer up a set of building blocks that let you compose your content in a certain way. So you can say, here's four lines of text. This line of text is large. And then you can just say, put it in this container, which groups it. You can say this container should have a certain amount of separation between the other container next to it. And what we're trying to let you do, similar to almost HTML1 in the very semantic web, is just describe your content with some semantic hints so that it can be rendered natively, not only cross-platform, but cross-experience. So it has to look like Skype on UWP, and it has to look like Skype on iOS. So we're cross-platform, but we're also cross-experience, that the experience owner ultimately controls the look and feel. Just like when you write Markdown documents on GitHub, they look and feel like GitHub. That same Markdown sent to a different site, like docs.msn, it completely looks different, but it's still my content. And that's what we're trying to do, to author your content with these building blocks, very similar to Markdown, but a little bit more card-like in a fixed window. Whereas Markdown's great at documents, we want to be really good at a kind of small card-like region.
Yeah, looking at one of these samples out here, there was, and maybe you're more familiar with this than I was, but there was a technology, like, God, it would have been more than a decade ago. It was like XML forms or something.
Well, there was something called,
I'm trying to find it online, but
are you trying to talk like schema.org stuff or
no, what you would do is it looked really similar. What you would do is in XML, you'd say,
HyperStack? Is that what you're referring to?
No, it was. I thought it was like XML forms or something, but it was really, okay. It was really similar. Where you would say, "Hey, I need a text box," and then here's these other properties that go along with it. And
it really
reminded me of that. Most of our listeners probably have no idea what I'm talking about.
XForms?
It might have been XForms. That's what I was trying to figure out if that was what it was.
The thing that I've realized is that, just like everything in technology, this is not some brand new mind-blowing invention. It's simply trying to apply it to a very specific scenario, which, a lot of people see it and they're like, well, how is this different than HTML and CSS? What you're describing is like HTML and CSS. And as you're kind of thinking like Markdown along the way, and the whole point is that this content is designed to be hosted in something else. It's for when you don't own both ends of the stack. And we really want to appease both people with this technology. And by the way, it's completely open source. We do all of our roadmap, our schema development. It's all in GitHub and all open source. We're trying to make this as open a standard as we can to get third party. We don't want this to be a Microsoft only thing. We do have Skype and Microsoft Teams and a handful of other Microsoft properties that will align to this. But we've also at Build, I got to have Kik on stage with me, which is really cool, announcing they're currently in prototyping. And we've just been working with a lot of people in the industry, because there's a reason that the industry is in where it is today. There's a reason Facebook Messenger only gives you 8 templates, and they're literally all airline templates, frankly. And it's because their users are very important. That controlled, constrained environment. There's a reason why you just don't let people open up a box to draw whatever they want. Mm-hmm. So we want to have, Facebook or Slack or anyone be like, okay, here's this constrained window. There's no security implementations. Adaptive cards are purely declarative. There's no code or anything. You just describe your content. And then you can safely open yourself up to this extensibility, because it's sorely lacking in the bot development, in cards in general. Everyone has these proprietary APIs. And we want these content authors to get that reach for free. Carl had mentioned schema.org, and we are similar to things like that, these microdata formats like Facebook Open Graph. Like, that's exactly why for people listening, there's a reason why when you go on Facebook.com or Twitter and you scroll through your feed, all those articles look exactly the same. All the videos, all the photos, these are templates that Facebook has described. And you, as the content author, you say, oh, this is an article. Here's my headline. Here's my image. Here's the summary. Here's the text. And you describe with that data. Yeah. And Facebook renders it just the way the same article shared to Twitter looks and feels like Twitter. We're trying to be like that, but more, a little more freeform, not just data. We're going to let you describe your card in a little richer way.
Yeah, I think this makes a lot of sense. I think it was a, I think it's a really nice balance. I think you guys have struck just the right balance there. And whenever I first saw, you know, some of these cards that pop up in bots, you know, where it'll have buttons and things like that, I'm like, mm-hmm. oh boy, this is this is not good. Because yeah. I was just thinking like this experience is going to be crazy across these different things. You know, maintaining the sameness yet the differences across them and
absolutely, yeah. it's already people can't or people, not that they can't, they do. That we as an industry spend billions of dollars maintaining an Android, an iOS, and a Windows app to ultimately look and feel identical to users. And we build on all these platforms. There's no way bots are going to compete in the same vein. You can't, there's no way you'll be able to write and maintain a Facebook Messenger bot and know their design language, a Skype bot and know their design language, because ultimately that's where bots are going to shine. You just want to talk to someone. We talked about iMessage earlier. You just want to be able to talk to your business.
I'll go ahead, Carl.
So I was going to say, like, you have me sold. This is a pretty awesome idea, but do you have some sort of SDK or kind of tooling to help me author this JSON so I can get this out there?
Yeah, well, we have a ton of tools out right now. We do have Notepad integration.
Come on, Carl.
So if you do go to adaptivecards.io, it'll link to our GitHub, which is just github.com/Microsoft/adaptivecards. We have SDKs on every major platform. So as I have harped on a handful of times here, bots and cards are all about reach. And so if you would want to adopt adaptive cards, we need to be wherever your users are. So if you have an iOS app, an Android app, an HTML app, we have SDKs for all of those platforms. We have a .NET WPF renderer. We have a Xamarin Forms renderer. We're still working on getting them all. We are in preview, I should preface to say. We're still building this thing. If any of your listeners have feedback in this area, we are actively talking to anyone. Just head to our GitHub. We have 100-ish users or so filed. A lot of them are schema proposals. We're looking to lock down the 1.0 schema this summer, soonish in the summer. But yeah, so we have SDKs for both if you're a card author, and also if you're a card renderer, like you're the Skypes of the world, or you're just some app who wants to open up to an ecosystem in a safe way, adaptive cards could be a great fit for that as well.
And how to create them? There's the visualizer on adaptivecards.io. There's a plugin for is the plugin for VS out there too?
Yeah, so we have a VS Code previewer that you can install as an extension. So as you're editing,
that's actually what I was just working on. So I got it. I have it installed, and I was looking at
nice.
It. I was going to mention it if you hadn't mentioned it.
Yeah. So yeah, we have a previewer there, so you can immediately kind of see your card in VS Code.
I haven't figured out how do I actually preview it then.
I think you have to hit. It's some weird, like, all VS Code. It's some weird combination of, like, four keystrokes. I think if you do Control-Shift, F1 to get the console.
Yeah, I think it's Control-Shift-V or something? No.
Yeah, I can't remember. It's some weird extension. It's like Alt-Shift-P or something. Yeah. The extension tutorial will tell you. It's Control-Shift-V-A.
Oh, Control-Shift-V-A. That's what I was missing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
that was my next
obviously.
Control shift. Well, you know, the editor world. You know, I come from Visual Studio.
Cool.
Where,
that's awesome. So
yeah, if anyone installs the Adaptive Card Viewer, that's our tutorial right in there. Control shift VA.
So you were mentioning earlier, like how Markdown has properties, so you can just like drop out and kind of go custom. Do you have like any way that I could define like a custom property or something like that, especially if I'm going to be having a custom renderer myself?
Yeah, totally. So that extensibility and customization like that, personally, I've been following along and trying to emulate as closely as I can with the .NET standard. So similar to .NET standard, right? It's a specification that is the standard, you know, just like Adaptive Cards 1.0, that's going to be our specification. And then a renderer ultimately will know how to render the 1.0 version of the schema. But if you have a custom property like I always have a hard time coming up with an example. But if you had a custom property and you want to then render it yourself, you can do that. Our renderer libraries, let's say you're on your UWP app or whatever, We have events that fire to let you customize. You can completely override how. So one of our elements is a text block. You can pass in a completely custom render if you want to take control over that rendering. So we definitely want to design with extensibility in mind, because we know that people, just like .NET Standard and the .NET platform, you will need custom stuff before it's ready to go through the standardization process. So, mm-hmm. you know, the only thing, the guidance we're offering is that you namespace some of those properties. So, you know, it should be Carl Schweitzer dot, you know, whatever property. And then it's at least namespace so that you can submit that as like, hey, I think this property could be useful. It can become part of the standard. And then, you know, then you don't get you know, conflict issues. But yeah, definitely extensibility. And if you adopt adaptive cards, we don't want it to be you take it wholesale. We want it to be accepted, but we definitely know that you'll need customization green.
This is really cool. This preview for VS Code, like it's like instantaneous. I mean, you're typing and yeah. the preview is updating. So
yeah,
that is very cool. This is how we do it.
I will say that we don't always say, so we talk a lot about the card visualization and just rich layout. It is more than that, though. We do have a set of actions you can put on the cards. As you click around our samples, you'll see some, like the weather large sample. We can do touch targets within the card that will execute actions. And again, they're all purely declarative, but it still lets you do some pretty cool stuff with take action on these things, including we have what we call the show card action, where you can have one card show another card. And that enables some really cool scenarios that like, hey, you're ordering this pizza order and you can say, I want this topping, which would then toggle down a set of options. And then you click on a different button, which would toggle down a different set of options. Mm-hmm. That we only let it go one level deep. Yeah. People are always like, wait, so one card can show another card. How many can we get? It's one for now.
Cards all the way down.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, so who's already using these cards?
So right now, the only place you can see and play with cards, if you go to Bot Framework and write a bot, the dev.botframework.com, their dashboard, it has a really cool test button. I think they've done a great job, that team, with dashboard. You basically just publish your bot and you click test, and it slides out with this little chat window, and you can talk to your bot right in there, kind of live debugging. Mm-hmm. So adaptive cards fully work there in that test environment. They have an emulator tool. What you'll see that I'm getting at is mainly tooling.
Yeah.
The Bot Framework tool supports adaptive cards, and they have this control called the web chat control.
Yep.
That lets you host a bot conversation within your own website or your own app, and adaptive cards work there. You'll see Skype soon. You'll see Microsoft Teams soon. You'll start to see a bunch of Microsoft properties light up over the coming months. And then you hopefully start to see even some third parties as those prototypes go. And you'll see them in more than just chat environments. At the keynote, at Build, the Windows keynote, we announced Microsoft Time, Windows Timeline. That uses adaptive cards. That API will light up soon in the fall creator update. And then you'll start to see those cards in the following release. So yeah, you'll see it in Windows, basically anywhere who wants to host these card-like experiences where you're going to start to see them, which is why if any of your listeners are intrigued by this topic, I mean, you can literally get in on the ground floor. We're getting pretty cool. I mean, our GitHub issues are mainly all like, hey, have you thought of this? They're not bugs so much because we're still early preview, but it's like, hey, people want video support. But then when you start thinking about video, you know, someone will comment, but be careful with that because I don't want people just automatically play video. So it's cool getting people's feedback, you know, and thinking of things in the broad community. It's certainly been fun for me as part of the developer platform to actually get to engage with people as we're building it.
So is there anything other than like videos that might not be good to use in adaptive cards, or at least not right yet now?
So anything that isn't that's hyper dynamic doesn't really work. So a lot of scenarios we get are people, you know, locations are a big one. So people want a map. If you imagine interactivity, you know, on Android, for example, everyone describes it as a widget, but the reality is there's two very different types of widgets. I have a widget on my phone that is my eight different presets of my Philips Hue lights, so I can quickly toggle lights. And all that is a grid, a 2x4 grid that has some actions and a button slider. That'd be a perfect adaptive. It's got actions, it can update itself, as in it can like redraw itself on action. But then there's another type of content, let's say like the Gmail inbox widget, where you're scrolling in it. You can like zoom into an email. It's got a whole life cycle, and it's this interactive kind of thing. That's not a good adapter. So adaptive cards are really when you have this static content, can do actions on them, but they really only refresh. You're not like scrolling adaptive. Not something like that. So like an interactive map.
Okay.
So when we talk about media, so how do we work with media in regards to adaptive cards? Because I'm assuming that we're not just sending a blob or a binary bit with these cards. So how do we as developers, how do we plan our infrastructure to be able to, you know, make these more dynamic and cool looking?
That's a good point.
Yeah, so right now, basically, we primarily only support HTTP resolvable assets. So you can is that what you mean by media? Like just assets, like
yeah. So you know if I have an image, I could base64 encode it, but I'm sure that would probably choke somewhere along the line, or at least make this so it's less reliable or slower.
Sure. Yeah. So for right now, we currently will basically only resolve HTTP images, GIFs for like basic things like emojis. You can do like the shortcut kind of colon, thumbs up, colon syntax to enhance with emojis. Mm-hmm. But basically anything you can do in Markdown, you can do in adaptive cards today. So it's primary images. We do have lots of aspirations to enable richer types of media. You could certainly imagine, as we work with HoloLens, to get 3D content in the card. Currently, that's all being figured out. But right now, it's mainly images and assets that can be resolved through the web.
Can you do the embedded base64 encoded images, though? Can you do that?
You can't right now, but
Carl said it was a bad idea. I'm just asking.
Yeah.
Cause it seems like for something small, I mean, that would actually be a lot quicker, cause it doesn't have to go out and fetch those other assets. So
yep, exactly.
I'll go open the GitHub issue.
I think
that
is in one of our.
But, exactly. GitHub issues.
But we also don't want to be putting around 4K images of Jason's new, drone either.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, maybe we do. I don't know. Who am I to judge? Did you have any other questions, Carl?
I was just going to ask if there's anything that you guys could tell us what's coming up soon or that we could see likely
stuff
for adaptive cards.
Yeah, so I don't have anything to just try to soften the expectation there. I don't have anything huge to announce right now. We're in really exciting prototype mode with a whole bunch of partners. Just applying this concept in ways that we just never thought possible. And that's, to me, the most exciting thing for people who just have these scenarios where, you know, I've always wanted to be able to embed this content or create an ecosystem of content. And the biggest thing that adaptive cards are different than, say, HTML is we always generate native UI. So an adaptive card on iOS always creates native iOS elements. It creates native Cocoa elements. That same card sent to Android will always create native Android UI. And that means you're free to do anything on that platform that you want. This isn't like we rendered HTML and then now you have to embed a web view into your app, because certainly that would impact scroll performance and things like that. So ultimately, how you choose to use cards, you can do all these creative things because they always create native UI on each platform. It lets you do some really neat things. And that's just kind of a teaser for some of the ways that you'll start to see people use creative things with adaptive cards in the next 6 months or so.
I think that's a really good reminder too, because I mean, especially as for people who have followed your previous episodes, you know, we've talked about live tiles, we've talked about notifications. This is kind of like definitely evolutions of each other.
Yeah,
the absolutely. Way. And, you know, I think it's really cool to see this broad jumping to these other platforms, too, and mm-hmm. not just get focused on the pigeonhole of Microsoft technologies.
Yeah. Yep.
OK, very cool. Anything we missed? Anything else you wanted to mention?
No, I'd say I'm sure you guys will have links, but check out adaptivecards.io. if you hear this today, I know our docs suck. I'm gonna make them better in about 4 days. So don't critique how bad our doc site is that we threw together at midnight. but yeah. So yeah, I'd say check that.
The docs will be coming to docs.microsoft.com. Like it'll be we'll have it all as part of the typical developer destination for docs and stuff.
That's very cool. We had an episode on docs a couple weeks ago, so everybody's familiar with the awesomeness of docs.
It is awesome. It's pretty cool.
That's great to hear. Okay, and actually, so I have some live feedback now on one of our news stories. So I had reached out to somebody who claimed that they had on the unlimited Dropbox storage, they claimed to have 28 terabytes of available storage on there. So I had him send me a screenshot, and you know, obviously it could be altered, but I have received the screenshot of a
alleged screenshot
of 26 or 28 terabytes of available storage. So that seems like there is a decent amount of headroom there. So I can't explain the people who have run into limits there. Okay, so Carl, what do we have for the dev tip of the week?
The dev tip of the week might be a little bit limited, but I have been working, as I've mentioned in the past, a lot in the IoT area, mm-hmm. and I've been recently working with Serial, especially Serial with UWP, and sometimes that gets to be interesting to debug. So there's this actually a really cool tool as part of the Arduino IDE. So if you go to arduino.cc and go to their software page, you can download the Arduino IDE, and right there in their window, you can actually have an open serial box that you can interact with. You just select the COM port and just start typing, and it'll send those messages and receive them back and forth. So if you're looking to set up just a quick and dirty way to work with serial, and like I said, this isn't necessarily old school programming because I'm doing it with UWP applications. So it's definitely a valid tool. Check that out. It was something that I had a coworker actually showed me after trying to figure out the best way to debug this. So very cool. I thought it was pretty cool.
Okay, guys, what I need you to do, let's have Matt go first. Pick a number between 1 and 4 inclusive and let me know what it is.
4.
Would you rather tap dance for 24 hours straight without stopping or walk backwards for an entire week?
Ooh. Would I be a good tap dancer?
I doubt it.
If you have to ask.
I am skeptical.
I'm walking backwards for a week.
That would be, you know, I wonder. At first, people would be confused, and they'd be like, "That guy must—he must know something." Yeah. It's like the Ferris Bueller scene where they were like driving the car in reverse, you know. To like,
I was actually thinking, you know, I have kids, so they were watching Cars recently, and there's a part where Mater just drives backwards, and he's an excellent at driving in reverse.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Cool story, Thomas. Can pick a number between 1 and 4, inclusive.
2.
Okay. Would you rather have 10 working tongues on your hands instead of your fingers? Or
see how he gets working stuff and I'm a crappy tech.
I haven't heard the other option, but I'm gonna pick working. The other option.
They explicitly say the tongues work.
Yeah. Or this is a game for kids, just so you know, but or have toes on your hands instead of your fingers.
Oh, definitely. Definitely the toes on my hands instead of fingers. I'm a germaphobe. Like if I had tongues on my fingers,
that's true.
Oh God, I couldn't. Yeah. I couldn't be talking to you people right now. Like,
oh, that's funny. Yeah,
they'd be in bags. Like.
Yeah, but your hands would look like this, right?
That's okay.
I don't know how that looks on the other side. Yeah. you really have to hunt and peck type. I mean, you would not. Or I never thought of this though. Like, are the toes as functional as your fingers? Because then you'd be like. You get like that new BlackBerry with like the physical keyboard, and you'd be a maniac because it feel like a full size keyboard to you. It was like boom.
I have nice toes, so I mean, I'm just saying, like they'd be good on my.
So check out a picture in our show notes of Thomas's toes. Okay, well, this show has definitely gone downhill. Let's just get this. Let's get this finished. Okay, Matt, where can people find you?
So on Twitter, it's just @MattHeidinger.
Okay.
And, you know, that, yeah, that's probably the best place to go.
Okay, sounds good. And Thomas, where can people find you?
Typically outside of Matt's office door, making sure that he's working.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
No, it's just at Thomas Fennell is the best on Twitter.
Perfect. And then we'll have a whole bunch of links in the show notes to all the stuff that we've been talking about. And where can people find you, Carl?
You can find me on Twitter at Carl Schweitzer.
And you can find me at ytechie.com or on Twitter at twitter.com/ytechie. So guys, thank you so much for coming on here and talking to us about adaptive cars. Very cool stuff.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's great.